with possible applications. And it's a joint seminar that Norbert and Andreas will give. So we can start. How do you want to do this? Do you want to just switch in the middle or?
Yeah, we will switch in the middle.
Okay. So then please, after each topic, just stop for 2 seconds and ask if there are any questions, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Please start.
So thank you for the invitation to this talk and for the introduction. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I think. Okay. So again, the topic today is an invitation to the new variables with possible applications, and the talk will be split by a split talk and given by Norbert Bodendorf and me, Andreas Thurn. And it's based on work we did in collaboration with Thomas Thiemann on high dimensional and supersymmetric extensions of loop quantum gravity. So let me start by giving you an outline of the talk. Please go to slide number 2. I'll start with a motivation, why we are interested in high dimensional loop quantum gravity and supergravity. And after that, my part of the talk mainly will be concerned with Hamiltonian formulations of general relativity. So I'll review several Hamiltonian formulations, starting by ADM formulation and then several extensions thereof, and also the Astrakhar-Barbera formulation. And hopefully I lead you in a more or less natural way to the new variables and show you how they are related to the other formulations and also compare them with the Astrakhar-Barbera formulation. Then I'll shortly comment on the Lagrangian derivation of these variables, comment on the quantization of the resulting theory, and also shortly mention generalizations thereof to various metafields. After that, in the second part of this talk, Norbert will tell you about possible applications of the new variables. So what we might possibly learn about solutions to the simplicity constraint and the connection between the canonical and the covariant formulation, applications involving the supersymmetry constraint, application towards high dimensional and possibly supersymmetric black hole entropy and cosmology, and also possible tests of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Okay, let me start with the motivation. Please go to slide number 4. Well, the quantum gravity research can be divided into 2 camps, the perturbative and the non-perturbative side. On the perturbative side, the most prominent approach is superstring theory or M theory, and on the non-perturbative side is loop quantum gravity. And of course, each of these approaches has its own requirements, or if you want, predictions. So superstring theory and M theory require additional particles, supersymmetry, and high dimensions. And of course, none of these has been seen in any experiments. But still, this also might be a chance, because future experiments might find hints towards any of these ingredients. And then from a string theory point of view, one can argue that, well, those ingredients are natural in string theory and M theory. OK, on the other hand, loop quantum gravity is, one could argue it's more flexible, because we can do with various metacouplings and supersymmetry, but we don't need to. But the framework is formulated in 3+1 dimensions, just because the Astrakhar-Barbera variables are formulated in this dimension. And we can be perfectly happy with this, because from all what we know, we live in 3+1 dimensions. But of course, future experiments, or also the LHC, could find evidence for higher dimensions. And then, it's good to know that the framework is also can be extended to higher dimensions. And I should mention works by Melos and Nicolai in 1997, which already did Astrakhar-Lagerue formulation of 11-dimensional supergravity, and also work by Nieto on 8 and 12-dimensional Astrakhar variables. But to the best of our knowledge, there is no general framework to attack higher dimensions. So this is the first motivation why we're interested in higher dimensions. And the second is that it would be nice to make contacts between superstring theory, M theory, and loop quantum gravity, or in general between different approaches to quantum gravity, because from such an endeavor one always can get interesting cross virtualizations between different approaches and learn from the strategies the others are employing. And there are already some works in this direction. So just to mention Diemann's loop quantization of string theory, of the string, and also work by Fairbairn, Nui, and Sardelli on a self-dual canonical formulation of the algebraic string. To make contact, one possible route is just to compare results. And this comparison might be done in 3+1 dimensions, which is natural from a loop quantum gravity perspective. But for string theory, we then have to get rid of a bunch of dimensions. And this reduction process is unfortunately highly ambiguous, also known as the landscape problem. So the alternative route is a comparison in higher dimensions, because both string theory and M theory are much less ambiguous in their natural dimensions 10 and 11. And a good starting point, therefore, are high-dimensional supergravity theories, which are, on the one hand, considered as low-energy limits of string theory and M theory, and on the other hand, have an action of the type gravity action plus more. And since we know that the loop quantum gravity framework is quite flexible, and so if you can deal with the high-dimensional gravity action with loop quantum gravity methods, then we can hope that we can also include this plus more term. Of course, supergravity theories are still quite complicated, and one might want to start with symmetry-reduced models like high-dimensional and possibly supersymmetric black holes or cosmology. And to this end, we think it's interesting to extend loop quantization to high dimensions and supergravities. And of course, many people already worked on this. And just to mention a few, Jacobson, Fulop, and Sadabuchi worked on Ashika-like reformulations of supergravities in four dimensions. And then there are works by Amon Dugon, Gambini, Obregon, and Pullin, and also Ling and Smolin, on the extension of the loop quantum gravity framework to supergravities, and more work by Smolin on loop quantization of topological M theory. And of course, there are more to mention. Okay, this was the motivation. Now I'll start my review of Hamiltonian formulations of general relativity, starting with the ADM formulation introduced by Arnowitz, Eser, and Meissner in 1962. So please go to slide number 6. And I will be rather brief here, so I assume that you all are quite familiar with this. So we start by the Einstein-Hilbert action, perform a D+1 split. We assume that the space-time manifold of dimension D+1 is topologically R times some d-dimensional spatial manifold sigma. Introduce a foliation into space-like surfaces sigma t, which are the images of one parameter family of embeddings x of the spatial manifold into the space-time manifold. And then we want to describe physics by time evolution of fields defined on sigma. So we pull back several fields to sigma, and important fields on sigma then are the spatial metric with Q, which is just the pullback of the space-time metric G, and A, B here are spatial tensorial indices, so they run from 1 to D. And another important field is the extrinsic curvature, which is related to the time derivative of the spatial metric. And then, after once invoking the Gauss-Kodachi equations, we arrive at the well-known split form of the Einstein-Hilbert action, where the plus sign here, the red plus sign, stands for a Lorentzian signature, and the minus sign for Euclidean signature. And after performing a Legendre transformation, we arrive at the ADM formulation, and the phase space is coordinatized by the canonical variables Q, the spatial metric, and its conjugate momentum P, which is related to the extrinsic curvature. And I should mention that all these tensors are actually symmetric tensors, both the metric and its conjugate momentum, and also the extrinsic curvature. The only non-vanishing Poisson brackets are given by Q, P equals to 1. And of course, we are in a totally constrained Hamiltonian system. So the Hamiltonian the linear combination of the spatial diffeomorphism and the Hamiltonian constraint, and they comprise a first class algebra, so the constraint algebra is closing. We won't need the specific form of the constraint, so the algebra and what follows, the only important thing is that it's first class. Okay, now we want to deal with several extensions of this formulation. And the first extension we will consider, so please switch to slide number 7, I call extended ADM1, and it's motivated by the fact that we might want to couple fermions, and then we should deal with a feline and not with a metric. So we introduce a SOD-valued feline, and the first equation in 1 is just how we can get back the spatial metric from a co-debine, and EAI now transforms into the defining representation of SOD. In the second equation in 1, we introduce a new field, KAI, and the small indices IJ now run also from 1 to D. And this KAI will become one of our canonical coordinates on the extended phase space. Since it's a one-form, its conjugate should be a vector density, so we introduce the densitized feline, capital E, which is nothing else than square root of determinant of Q times the feline. And then the first two equations in 1 just define a map from the extended phase space to the ADM phase space. We postulate on this extended phase space the possible bracket relations E, K equals to 1, so, and all others vanishing. And of course, we increase the number of degrees of freedom since the metric and its conjugate were symmetric matrices, but now E and K are arbitrary D times D matrices, and the difference is exactly an anti-symmetric matrix. And since you know that in the ADM formulation KAD should be symmetric, we impose the constraint that the anti-symmetrization of KAB, like in 1, should vanish, which is then equivalent to GIJ on the right-hand side of equation 2. And this constraint now generates SOD rotations on both K and also on E. And if you look at the first two equations in 1, we just introduced an SOD gauge freedom, and this constraint actually reduces this gauge freedom again, so that's exactly what we should do. And in the end, we have to check if this extension actually is a valid extension, which means that the reduction, the symplectic reduction with respect to this Gauss constraint leads us back to the ADM phase space. To this end, we have to check that the ADM Poisson bracket relations are reproduced on the extended phase space, at least up to the Gauss constraint, so this new constraint GIJ. And this actually is the case. So if we take the expressions in 1 and calculate these brackets, then we get back the ADM Poisson brackets. Moreover, the new constraints close amongst themselves, and also it's obvious since in 1 all internal indices are contracted in a sensible way that Q and P, like in 1, are Dirac observables with respect to the new constraints, and in particular, since the Hamilton and the spatial diffeomorphism constraints are just functions thereof, they are also Dirac observables, and therefore, by construction, we obtain a first class constraint algebra. So this implies that this actually is a valid extension of the ADM phase space, and of course, I'm just reviewing things you already know. In the next step, we will turn this formulation into a connection formulation, namely the Ashika-Barbera formulation, and based on works by Sen, then seminal papers by Ashika and also Imusi and Barbero. So please switch slide to slide number 8. Well, we have to ask the question if there is a connection which is naturally related to the feline we just introduced, and of course the answer is yes, there's the spin connection which annihilates the feline, and its defining equation is given here in the first line. And for what comes next, we have to actually restrict ourselves to dimension D equals 3, because then the gauge group is SO3, or if you want to couple fermions, it's double cover SU2. And it's crucial for the following, that the defining and the joint representation of SU2 are equivalent. And therefore, we can perform only in D equals 3 the canonical transformation from EK variables to the variables 1 over gamma E and gamma K. Okay, there is just a constant rescaling with a real number gamma, which should not be zero, and it's called the Mirsky parameter. And of course, this constant rescaling is a canonical transformation, but then we add to gamma K the spin connection, contracted with an epsilon symbol, and the resulting object A actually gives us the Ashigaba-Barrow connection. And since this transformation is canonical, we know that we have a simple Poisson algebra, so A, E equals 1, and the other Poisson brackets are vanishing, and we also have a first-class constraint algebra like before. But I should mention that the canonicity of the above transformation is non-trivial, because in A we mixed basically momenta and coordinates. In particular, the Poisson bracket between two connections, that this bracket vanishes, depends on a crucial property of the spin connection, namely its integrability, but I don't want to go into details here. Okay, then we can rewrite the old constraints, so the constraints from our first extension in terms of these new variables E and A, and then this new constraint we introduced, Gij, actually becomes the form of the SU2 Gauss law constraint. So first we introduce this rescaling we did before, and then we add a term which is actually zero, so in the upper line of 5, the second term in square brackets is zero, just because the spin connection annihilates the field line, and then we can recombine those terms to give us the lower expression in 5, which is nothing else than the familiar SU2 Gauss law constraint. We can also rewrite the other constraints, but we don't need this the following, so I refrain from displaying it. And okay, now we have this connection formulation, and the natural question to ask is, does this work in higher dimensions also? And the answer is no, at least not in an obvious way, because we combined K, which transforms in the defining representation of SOD, and gamma spin, which transforms in the adjoint representation. And in general, there's no way of combining these two in a mathematically sensible way, and just because of the special properties of SO3 or SU2, we can combine them here. Okay, since this did not work in higher dimensions, we have to try another extension of the ADM phase space, so please go to slide number 9. And actually, we could have introduced, we introduced an SOD valued field line, but we could have introduced some field line valued in an arbitrary dimensional space, and then we would have had to introduce higher dimensional groups. And there's another natural group which one might want to introduce, which is SOD plus 1 or SO1 comma D, and the resulting object is called hybrid, or we call it now hybrid field line in the following. So again, the first two equations in 6 are the same as before, just that now the capital indices I and j run from 0 to d. And instead of the Kronecker delta, we now have eta ij, which is either a Kronecker or the Minkowski metric, depending on the gauge group. And again, we want to use this kij as one of the canonical coordinates, and then we have to introduce a vector density, capital E, which is the densitized hybrid field line. And all these objects, eai and kij, now transform in the defining representation of SOD plus 1 or SO1 comma D. And there is a motivation for the use of these variables, which is the second order Palatini formulation of general relativity. So a connection with a field line where the connection is now in independent degree of freedom. Then after the B plus 1 split, we can pull back the space-time field line and obtain exactly this hybrid field line as a variable. But then the gauge group, of course, will be fixed to the will be determined by the signature of space-time, and we will not make this restriction here. So we will allow for SOD plus 1 also in the Lorentzian theory. We can postulate the Poisson brackets EK equals to 1, and we need new constraints. Of course, we again want the KAB anti-symmetrized is 0, but this is insufficient here because this would be the same number of constraints we introduced before, and the hybrid field line has more more components than a normal field line. So we instead use G capital IJ, which is the natural generalization of what we had before, and also it generates SOD plus 1 or SO1 comma D rotations on K and E, so that's exactly again the constraint we should use. And then the proof that this extension actually is a valid extension is completely analogous to the previous case, and basically all the calculations are the same. So also this is a valid extension of the ADM phase space, and we have to ask if we can turn it into a connection formulation. Okay, and the first question is there a connection which is naturally associated to this hybrid field line? And the answer is yes, there is a hybrid spin connection, exactly in the case where the internal space is one dimension bigger, like here. Haldane showed in 1994 that there is this hybrid connection which satisfies this equation in the first line of the red box. So it annihilates the hybrid field line, but again, the k variable we introduced, it transforms in the defining representation of SOD plus 1 or SO1D, while the connection transforms in the adjoint, and therefore we cannot combine them in a mathematically sensible way. Except if the D equals 2, because then we're back in the SO3 case, and we can use the special properties of SO3. And actually this is related to the 2 plus 1 dimensional Ashtikov variables, this fact. But in the general case, again, we have to stop here. And okay, a short summary would be we introduce a field line which transforms in the defining representation of some group. Then its conjugate K will also transform in the defining representation of some group. And then we introduce a connection which is somehow related to the field line and transforms in the adjoint representation of the group. And then, of course, K and gamma cannot be combined. And so one could get the idea, why do we not start from a field line which transforms in the adjoint representation of the group? Because then the k variable we will get also will transform in the adjoint representation of the group. And therefore we can simply add the connection gamma if we manage to find constraints which nicely reduce the degrees of freedom from the field line in the adjoint representation to the ADM phase space, and if we manage to construct connection which is somehow related to this field line then. And well, now there are two possible ways how one could proceed. Either one could consider a field line which transforms in the adjoint representation of SOD or in the adjoint representation of SOD plus 1 or SO1 comma D. And well, at least for us, we didn't manage to find a possibility to make the first route work, but we managed to do the second route, and that's exactly why I introduced this second extension of the ADM phase space. So please go to slide number 11. Okay, perhaps, are there questions up to now?
Yes, there is a question about the formula six on corresponding to 9. So the indices I and J, they in three-dimensional, in the usual 3 plus 1 dimensional case, they would take 4 values rather than 3.
I'm sorry, the connection is quite...
Your answer is yes.
Oh, I see. Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question, but I think it's clear now.
Oh, my question concerns this equation speed and the range of the indices I and J.
Okay.
So it seems that this is that in the usual case of 3 plus 1, gravity will be 0, 1, 2, and 3. Is this correct? Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we can continue.
Okay. So then please go to slide number 11. And the third, we'll introduce now a third extension of the ADM phase space by introducing a generalized field line, by which I mean Q-line which transforms in the adjoint representation of SOD plus 1 or SO 1 comma D. So the first two equations in 8 now should look very familiar. The first is again how we can get the metric from this generalized C-line, and in the second how we can get the extrinsic curvature from K, a new variable, and E. And all those variables now are again the capital indices I and J run from 0 to D, but all those K and E are actually anti-symmetric matrices because, yeah, they should transform the adjoint representation of SOD plus 1. And then the conjugate to this K, A, I, J, again, should be a vector density. So to keep with the notation of this talk, I should call this pi A, I, J actually a capital E. But since in all our papers we call this pi, I will call this pi from here. And again, the motivation for those variables comes from Palatini formulation of general relativity, but this time from first order. Because if you start from first order Palatini formulation, we have a SOD plus 1 or SO 1 comma D connection. And if you pull it back to the spatial slice, its conjugate momentum will exactly have the index structure of the pi variable in 8. Moreover, it at least weakly satisfies the first equation in 8. So one can actually get back the metric on this. Again, we postulate the Poisson brackets relations that pi and k, the conjugate pair, and the other brackets are vanishing. So the other brackets vanish. And now we need new constraints. Okay, we introduced SOD plus 1 or SO 1 comma D gauge freedom in 8. So to get rid of this, we introduce again a Gauss constraint. And the index structure of this Gauss constraint, GIJ, is exactly the same of the one before. It looks a little bit different, but just because K and pi now in the adjoint representation, it again just generates gauge transformations in K and on pi. But since we know that the number of these constraints is exactly the same as before, we know what this constraint will do. Namely, it will constrain a hybrid field line to, it will constrain starting from a hybrid field line back to the ADM phase space. But we don't have a hybrid field line, but we have a generalized field line, so we need another constraint, which reduces the degrees of freedom from a generalized field line to a hybrid field line. And this constraint actually is given by the simplicity constraint, which is given in the second equation in 9. And, the simplicity constraint is well known both from Plevansky formulation and, of course, also from spin form models. And actually, this constraint is a little bit different than the ones used in BF theory because, in BF theory, you have actually have a two-form, so you have more, the B field is a two-form, you have more constraints, and our simplicity constraints are just a subset of the BF simplicity constraints. But the solution to this constraint actually can be easily inferred by looking at a paper on high-dimensional BF theory by Fredel, Krasnov, and Puccio in 1999. So please look at equation 10. If the simplicity constraint vanishes, pi has to be given by the antisymmetric product of n times E, capital E. And capital E here is nothing else than the hybrid field line we had in the last slide. And the n is a unit normal, and actually it's a function of E. It's a unique unit normal, which is normal to all these hybrid field lines. So the hybrid field line are actually D vectors in a D plus one dimensional space, so I can construct a unit normal, and this is exactly what this n is. Okay, so the idea is the simplicity constraint reduces the degrees of freedom in this generalized field line to a hybrid field line, and then the Gauss constraint does the rest and constrains the hybrid field line to come back to the ADM phase space. And again, the proof that this extension is valid is analogous to the first two cases. Actually, it's not much more complicated. The only new ingredient is the simplicity constraint, but the calculations are not more complicated than before. And now we can perform a canonical transformation to a new connection formulation. But first, we have to introduce a connection. And how can we get this connection? Well, actually, we know that on the surface where the simplicity constraint vanishes, there we have the hybrid field line, and for the hybrid field line, we have a natural connection, namely the hybrid connection from the last slide. And also this hybrid connection annihilates the pi variable, at least on the surface where the simplicity constraint vanishes, because it annihilates the E, and on the surface where the simplicity constraint vanishes, pi is given by E, by the hybrid field line. So we simply extend this hybrid connection off the simplicity constraint surface, and the connection we then obtain will at least weakly annihilate this pi. And then we can perform the canonical transformation from pi and k to 1 over beta pi and beta k. So again, just a constant rescaling with a real parameter, which is not zero, and also is non-equivalent to the inertia parameter, and simply add the hybrid connection to beta k without further further modifications. And then we obtain a real connection A. And again, we can rewrite the constraints in terms of the new variables, and like before, since the hybrid connection annihilates pi, we add 0 to the Gauss constraint, which is given in 9, and obtain this familiar SOD plus 1 or SO1 comma D Gauss law constraint. And again, we have to also rewrite the other constraints, but I'm not going into detail here. And I want to point out that this works both for SOD plus 1 and SO1 comma D independent of the space-time signature. So in particular, we can treat Lorentzian general relativity with compact gauge-proof SOD plus 1. Okay, then go to the next slide, number 12, and let me quickly compare this with the Astrakhanov-Barrow formulation. Well, most ingredients are the same, so we have real variables because we have chosen the parameters beta and gamma to be real. We have simple Poisson algebra, so the connection and its conjugate if one and the other brackets are vanishing. The gauge group is SU2 for the Astrakhanov-Barrow formulation, whereas it is SO4 for the new formulation if the dimension is 3. The first Gauss constraints in the first case are the Hamiltonian, the special diffeomorphism, and the Gauss constraint. In the second case, we additionally have the simplicity constraints. Now, the physical information in the connection, and with physical information, I mean the information on the extrinsic curvature. And in the Astrakhanov-Barrow formulation, this is just the Astrakhanov-Barrow connection minus the spin connection. While in the new formulation, if we introduce a time gauge, so if we fix some internal normal, we actually, SOD gauge freedom remains, and we get an SOD connection. But this connection actually has no information on the extrinsic curvature, but the information on the extrinsic curvature sits in the boost components of the new connection. And that's also why, the physical information somehow enters this new connection in a different way than it does in the Astrakhanov-Barrow connection, and that's why we also claim that the parameters beta and gamma are different, because they enter at different points in the construction. And then the relation to other formulations, well, as we have seen, the Astrakhanov-Barrow formulation is related to the extension 1 by a canonical transformation, and if we solve the Gauss constraints, we come back to ADM, while the new formulation, if we solve the simplicity constraint, we come back to our second extension in terms of a hybrid field line. If we furthermore choose time gauge, we come to the first extension of ADM, and if we furthermore solve the rest of the Gauss constraints, we come back to ADM. And I should note that there is another, so in D equals V, there is another reformulation, so we can perform another canonical transformation to get other new variables, where we then have a two-parameter family of connections. So we can introduce the initial parameter in this new formulation in D equals 3, and then actually, if we solve the simplicity constraint and choose time gauge, we obtain Astrakhanov-Barrow formulation instead of the extended ADM1. But this, or at least we don't know how this could generalize to higher dimensions. Okay, then switch to slide number 13, and let me briefly comment on the Lagrangian derivation of these variables. To this end, we start by first order Palatini action, which was studied, for example, by Peldan in 1994, and perform a canonical analysis thereof. The action in 15 is already presented in the D plus 1 split version, so pi is a momentum conjugate to A, and as we see, it's exactly the same index structure than the pi variable we had before. Then we have a Hamilton, a special diffeomorphism, and the Gaussian simplicity constraint, and the Gaussian simplicity constraint are exactly like before. But actually, the Hamilton constraint is not, and therefore, if we perform the Dirac constraint analysis, we will obtain an additional constraint because the simplicity constraint is not stable under the time evolution. And this new constraint is the second class partner to the simplicity constraint. And if we have second class constraints, we have to get rid of them before we quantize. And if we calculate the corresponding Dirac bracket, then the connection will not be self-commuting anymore. And this was calculated by Alexandrov in 2000. And therefore, loop quantization is not directly applicable. There are, however, some works which try to deal with this non-commutativity by Alexandrov and Roche, for example, and also works works which try to find connections which are self-commuting with respect to this Dirac bracket, which are then not this connection but other connections. And this also has been done partly by Alexandrov and also by Geiler and collaborators in 2011. How we proceeded here is to invoke the procedure of gauge unfixing, which was introduced by Nitra and Jayaraman, Hello and Teitelbaum, and Anicetti and Ideswaran. And this is a well-defined procedure to turn a second-class constraint system into a first-class constraint system. And applied to general relativity, it amounts to dropping the D constraint at the cost of a more complicated Hamiltonian constraint. So we have to modify the Hamiltonian constraint, but then we can drop the D constraint and the simplicity constraint becomes first class. And the resulting theory we obtain, if you follow these lines, actually coincides with the result of the Hamiltonian derivation I just sketched if the internal and external signatures match. Of course, since we're here starting from an action, the gauge group is determined by our space-time signature. And also the free parameter we could introduce in the Hamiltonian derivation, beta should be equal to zero. Okay, then let's come to quantizations and generalizations. The next slide, number 14.
Can I ask a question here? In the previous discussion, when you are doing 3 plus 1 dimensions, you were using a gauge group which are just SO4, even in the Lorentzian signature, I thought. Was that not the case?
Yeah, that's the case.
Right. But now you are saying in the transparency number 13, you are saying that, in fact, this consistency, in order to deal with this second-class constraint, that consistency will force you to say that the internal and external signatures match, which means that in the Lorentzian case, the signature must be SO3-1.
No. So the idea is if you start from an action, the gauge group is already fixed. If I start from Palatini action, the gauge group is tied to the space-time signature. So starting from Palatini action, I can only derive this Hamiltonian formulation where the internal and external signatures match. But if I come from the Hamiltonian, I can do more. I can also derive the theory whether both do not match. But so then I do not have an action for this theory.
Right. So that's not exactly the question. The point is that if you did the other way around, that is, if you use SO4 in the case of 3 plus 1 Lorentzian signature, then you would not, it would not arise from an obvious action principle.
Exactly.
But thank you.
Okay. Then let me briefly comment on quantization on slide number 14. So as we know, most of the results of loop quantization are actually formulated independently of dimension of space-time and the choice of compact gauge group. And of course, many people have contributed to this, and I'm sorry if I'm not mentioning everybody, but of course I can't. So from a quantization perspective, the sole new ingredient for the canonical theory actually is the implementation of the simplicity constraint. But this constraint is well known from the covariant approach, and perhaps their strategies can just be imported. But we will come to this later. And then we also know that the loop quantization framework is quite flexible, and we can add diverse matter fields and supergravity, and also here we can couple Dirac-Weil, Mariano fermions, gauge fields for compact gauge groups, scalar fields, Rarita-Schwinger fields, so gravitinos, which is important for supergravity, abelian higher p-form fields, and what is not treatable so far are non-abelian higher p-form fields, and perhaps higher gauge theory can help here, but we don't know. And also non-compact gauge groups are problematic, but yeah, I basically have nothing to say here. But from what we can treat, we already include supergravity theories in 4, 10, and 11 dimensions, which of course, due to my motivation, also are interesting for us. Okay, at this point, I will stop and Norbert will continue with the shorter part, slightly shorter part. So if we have any questions here, feel free to ask.
There's a question here.
So is this A connection into principal bundle? It's not, right? The A field that you define is not, what is its geometrical meaning? Is it?
You're asking about the geometrically meaning of this A field.
Yeah, it's not a collection of a principal bundle, right? Because I thought it's taking values in the adjoint representations.
So if I'm coming from the action, I'm pretty sure that it is. If I'm doing the signature switch, well, then I would have to study global aspects, which we never did. So.
Okay, thanks.
So, again, you ended with this quantization slide. So, again, I want to go back to the remark that I was making before. So, for this quantization purposes, you have to take this point of view, which is kind of a Hamiltonian point of view, for which there may not be any action principle. Is that correct? Because you would like to use gauge group, which is compact, in order to... Yeah. So, you are taking this point of view, just in Hamiltonian framework and then go to quantum theory.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are there any other comments or questions? Okay, if not, let's continue.
Okay, so hello everyone, so I'm going to continue now with the talk and with the possible applications of the new variables. And first of all, we are going to talk about three examples which come from within loop quantum gravity, but then we will also go a bit broader and see how or what we can do in order to compare loop quantum gravity to other approaches to quantum gravity, for example, string theory. Let's go to slide number 60, solutions to the simplicity constraint. Now, as you all know, the simplicity constraint is a vital part of loop quantum gravity, and especially in the covariant formulation where it relates the F theory, which is easy to quantize, to general relativity, which is the theory that we want to quantize. However, imposing the simplicity constraint is a bit tricky because, as you know, it's the second class on the quantum level, and therefore the original proposal by Barrett and Crane to impose all the constraints strongly is not favored anymore, but people came up with different implementations, for example, the weak implementation leading to the EPRL model or coherent state methods leading to the FK model, but very recently also the use of holomorphic simplicity constraints and maximally commuting subsets. So it's nice to have all those implementations, however, at this point we have to ask the question if they lead to the same dynamics. And if they maybe do not lead to the same dynamics, we should have some procedure to choose the right implementation. And what we want to propose on the slide is to use the new framework for this for maybe two reasons. So first point, we can now implement all those or some of those proposals also in the canonical theory, because here we also have to quantize the simplicity constraint, and we can then check the dynamical equivalence of those implementations by, for example, looking at the kernel of different Hamiltonian constraints, which can be derived from the different implementations of the simplicity constraint. However, in the, we also have in three dimensions the Ashikaga-Bero variables, which do not have the simplicity constraint at the quantum level, and therefore we can also check for a dynamical equivalence to the Ashikaga-Bero formulation. Now, on the other hand, there's something new appearing in the canonical theory, which is the constraint algebra. And in order to have a well-defined theory, your algebra should be reasonably anomaly-free. And if you look, for example, at the classical Poisson algebra of constraints, you will see that the Poisson bracket between a simplicity constraint and a Hamiltonian constraint in equation 16, it gives you again a simplicity constraint. And when you now quantize this expression, you'll probably arrive at the following commutator equation, that the simplicity constraint and the Hamiltonian constraint operators gives you again a simplicity constraint operator. And it's really important that such an equation is actually satisfied in the quantum theory, because what it tells you is that you can actually implement the Hamiltonian constraint on the solution space of the simplicity constraint, because it leaves this solution space invariant. However, if you would encounter an anomaly in this equation, for example, a unit operator on the right-hand side, then your Hamiltonian constraint would not leave the simplicity solution space invariant, and you would not be able to implement the simplicity or the Hamiltonian constraint in this way. And this would somehow be bad, because the simplicity constraint, like the Gauss constraint, they are somehow a kinematical constraint, and you want to implement your Hamiltonian constraint, which contributes to the hypersurface deformation algebra, somehow on this kinematical level. And you can even go further here and look, for example, at the commutator of two Hamiltonian constraints, which in the classical theory, again, gives a simplicity constraint. And also here, it's important that no anomalies appear in the quantum theory. So just to repeat this again, so we want also to look for anomaly freedom in the canonical theory. And maybe by this procedure, we can select some implementations of the simplicity constraint. So let's switch slides. Now slide number 17. So another important problem in quantum gravity is the equivalence of the canonical and the covariant formulation. And in fact, the covariant formulation was originally proposed in order to provide dynamics for the canonical theory. And the idea was that the physical scalar product of two states, phi and psi, given as an equation 17, as the spin form amplitude with a boundary corresponding to those states. And therefore, the spin form amplitude would be a kind of rigging mat for the Hamiltonian constraint. However, when thinking about proving this equation and thinking about the new canonical framework, a natural question arises, which is, for which canonical quantization should we actually test the above equation? And directly related to this question is, are the quantum theories based on the Ashikaga-Bero and the newly proposed variables equivalent? Because if they are not, then and we don't know that yet, one should think about this question before actually performing large calculations for proving equation number 17. So we don't really have an answer for this here. However, we just want to briefly comment on what are the up and downsides of using those variables for this problem. And when you, if you want to implement equation number 17 or test it, then you first have to look at the kinematical Hilbert spaces of your series. And when using Ashikaga-Bero variables, then your Hilbert space is based on the group SU2. However, the spin-form models are based on the Lorentz group, and then you implement the simplicity constraint on this Hilbert space, but then you have to relate the Hilbert space to each other. And depending on your implementation of the simplicity constraint, this relation might not be unique, and you have to deal with those non-uniqueness issues at this level. However, when using the new variables for matching internal and external signature, then the simplicity constraints are also quantized here, and therefore you can use the same methods as in your spin-form model, and therefore you don't have this problems of relating the Hilbert space to each other. However, when it now comes to the hard calculations, then the Ashikaga-Bero variables seem to be favored, because what you have to do is you have to look at the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraint operator, and as Andreas said, in the new formulation, it acquires a new term, which comes from this gauge on fixing, and therefore calculations seem to be harder here. So again, there's no no clear answer here at this point. However, you have to think about those questions when dealing with equation number 17. So let's switch slides now to slide number 18. Now, another important problem in this quantum gravity is to understand the solution space of the Hamiltonian constraint operator, especially when including matter fields. Now, by itself, this is a very complicated problem. However, when doing supergravity, we get a new hint on how to make progress here. And this was first noted by Claudio Teitelbaum already in 1977. And what he basically said is that the supersymmetry constraint, the curly S here, is somehow the square root of all the other constraints. So when you look at the Poisson algebra, then the anti-Poisson bracket of two supersymmetry constraints actually gives you all the other constraints. And if you now assume that you can implement this algebra anomaly free on the quantum level, then whenever you have a solution to your supersymmetry constraint operator, it will automatically be also a solution to your Hamiltonian constraint operator. And therefore, the idea would be to study a supergravity as a simplified version of general relativity coupled to matter, then construct solutions to the supersymmetry constraint by invoking supersymmetry arguments, and then you automatically get this solution to the Hamiltonian constraint. But now we have solutions to the Hamiltonian constraint, including matter fields, and you can study them and see how this works, and then maybe infer on how to construct more general solutions of general relativity coupled to matter. And just to mention that this might actually be a fruitful line of research, so there was important progress in implementing the supersymmetry constraint operator by Armando Gonin, Gambini, Obregon, and Pullin, and they were working in four-dimensional supergravity using Ashikar variables, but instead of SU2, they used a graded Lie group, which is some fermionic extension of SU2, and it incorporates also your super degrees of freedom, and there they could implement half of the supersymmetry constraint by using basically symmetry arguments, so they were constructing something like a super holonomy instead of a holonomy. Okay, now let's switch slides, slide number 19. So as mentioned before, we want also to think about comparing loose quantum gravity to other approaches of quantum gravity. And when you scan the literature, you will immediately find a string theory. And in the context of string theory, supergravity has been studied extensively at low energy limit. And in this studying, a great deal of technology has been developed in order to deal with these problems. So it would be very interesting if we could somehow import some of this technology in order to deal with our own problems, for example, as mentioned on the last slide, by using or constructing solutions to these supersymmetry constraints, but also it would be nice if we might be able to solve other people's problems here in our method. So how to compare loop quantum gravity to string theory? As Andreas mentioned before, the dimensional reduction of string and M theory to four dimensions is not unique, and therefore we propose to work actually in the natural dimensions of string and M theory, and there to quantize the corresponding supergravity theory by the canonical methods we developed. And then again, since generic calculations are hard in both loop quantum gravity and string theory, to work in symmetry reduced situations would be better for the beginning. So let's switch slides and black hole entropy now. Now, one of those situations is the calculation of black hole entropy, and here we are in the nice situation that we actually have calculations available from different theories. So first of all, we have the thermodynamic analogy and the quantum field theory and curved space-time pioneered by Bekenstein and Hawking, but also there are results available from string theory and quantum gravity. So in string theory, the calculations also include higher dimensions and supersymmetry. So therefore, what we propose here is to use the new variables also to study the black hole entropy in higher dimensions and also considering supersymmetry. And here are a lot of things happening. For example, the topology of the black hole is not restricted to be a sphere, but could also, for example, be a tori. And therefore, it would be very interesting to compare these things to calculations coming from string theory. Now, switching sides again, cosmology. Cosmology is also one of those situations. We have calculations in the original Wheeler de Witt quantum cosmology, but also string cosmology and loop quantum cosmology. And again here, what we propose to do is to actually study supersymmetric and higher dimensional loop quantum cosmologies. And
then compare this to string theory. However, here we think it's also very interesting to study supersymmetric entire dimensional loop quantum cosmology for its own sake, because if nature should really be supersymmetric or higher dimensional, then it's conceivable that observational effects of those symmetries or higher dimensions might be detectable in cosmological observables which are sensitive to quantum effects, for example, in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And it would be very interesting if we could now compare this calculations in higher dimensions to calculations in 3+1 dimensions, and if we see there that there are different predictions, then it would be very interesting to look for those. Now let's switch slides again, slide number 22. Now, since this is our last slide, it's also the most speculative one, and we don't pretend to know much more about the topic than what is written on those slides, however, we think it's very interesting if one could make progress here. Now, the basic conceptual framework is that there's a conjecture equivalence between two classes of theories, which are gravity theories on the one side and H theories on the other side, and the most prominent example here would be the relation between the type 2B string theory on ADS5 times of 5 to n equals to 4 super Young Lisp theory in 4 dimensions. And this equivalence is basically the conjecture to be between certain coupling constants of the theory. So on the string side, we have the string coupling GS and the string tangent T. And on the Young Lisp side, we have the Young Lisp coupling G Young Lisp and the number of colors n. However, it's very difficult to test this conjecture at this high energy level, and therefore in order to perform calculations, what one normally does is one goes to a low energy level, and on the string side one takes string coupling and then strong string tension, and then only massless states survive, and you end up with a type 2B supergravity. And on the Young-Lisp side, you use weak Young-Lisp coupling and strong Tolf coupling, which is just the equation on the right lower box there, G Young Lisp squared times n goes to infinity, and this limit only planar Feynman diagrams will survive, and therefore also calculations in Young Lisp theory will become that much easier. However, one wants to test this equivalence, also now in this low energy limit, the equivalence is very well tested. However, one also wants to test this equivalence in different factors of quantum supergravity, and basically in this low energy level, you do some kind of perturbation theory on the supergravity side. However, one can now ask the question, how can we improve this here? And I'll switch slides again to slide number 23. So what we propose to do is to study actually loop quantized type 2B supergravity and then relate it to some factor of super Young Lisp theory. However, again, this is very tentative, and as you can see, there are a lot of question marks there. But if one could get this to work, it would be very interesting because you would be able to make predictions for super Young Lisp theory, and now this ADS-CFT correspondence also seems to work for different theories, not only this ADS-5 tensor 5, but also lower dimensional theories. And it also has applications in solid state physics, for example, and therefore it would be very interesting to make progress here. So let's switch slides to the conclusion now, slide number 25. So what we try to show you is that there exists formulation of D+1 dimensional Lorentzian general relativity on an SO D+1 Young Lisp phase space, and loop quantum gravity methods apply to this theory, and therefore a rigorous quantization exists. There are extensions to interesting supergravity theories, and we have listed several possible applications. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. So I've got time for questions, comments. Okay, let me just get the ball rolling by asking this question again. So if one does want to look at the quantum theory that is supposed to come out of this new formulation, then as was explained by Andrea, we have to really take the Hamiltonian point of view and not so much a Lagrangian point of view, and think of the internal group as being a compact group. So for example, to be concrete, in 3+1 dimensions, the internal group would be just SO4, which is compact, and therefore one can go ahead and use the known techniques of non-perturbative quantization from loop quantum gravity. But those techniques require, really, they're based on a strong, they make a very strong use of the fact that, in fact, what the basic variable is really a connection of principal bundle, because after all, everything is done in terms of holonomies, etc., etc. We use a theorem which says that, you know, if you know all the holonomies, you know the connection, and so on. But Andreas was saying that in this case, in this hybrid case, where the space-time signature is minus plus plus plus, but the signature of the internal space is plus 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 plus, in this case, it was not so clear that this was actually a connection of principal bundles. So isn't there a worry that one may not be able to use, I mean, maybe one can just show it is, but if it is not, then isn't there a worry that that one would not be able to use the techniques that we have in quantum geometry?
So actually, we haven't worried too much about this, but I agree with you that one should actually really study this problem. So basically, it reduces to studying, for example, SOD plus one bundles over a d-dimensional manifold. So since the time direction or the minus direction is somehow absent in the Hamiltonian formulation because you're just working on the spatial slice, it's really an SOD plus one bundle over a d-dimensional manifold, and you should study those. But we didn't do this so yet. However, I agree that it should be studied.
Okay. I mean, the worry would be the kind of thing that Alexander actually said, like that if you don't use fixed time gauge, then this is not really a connection, and so on. So, yes. But thank you. Other questions or comments? Okay, so I'm just filling in for Jorge because he is in Montevideo. I think Jorge will be back next time. Let us thank both Robert and Andreas again.